Okay, I think Commissioner Fritz will be rejoining us momentarily. So I know there are a bunch of questions, but I guess I'd like to try to get back to some context here, which I tried to do earlier. So refresh my memory. Again, you know, we've had either 4 or 5 major city council hearings on this subject over the course of the last year. I think there's a prospect that this hearing could be endless given the constant arrival of new technical issues as we've witnessed here today. It's my very fervent belief that it should not be endless and we should make some decisions and then move on to perhaps addressing some of those issues, but I'll get back to that. But recontextualize this for me. At this point in the United States, how much of the United States is regulating TNCs and how much is not?
So the regulations are mostly occurring in large and medium urban cities.
Right. And it's a fraction of the country, right? Most of the country, TNCs are operating without any regulation whatsoever, right? And so I assume there's insurance cases and litigation and that kind of stuff going on in those places, right? So we'll get back to that. Then secondly, of the cities that are regulating, if there's a scale of not much to a lot, where does Portland's current standards as proposed fall on that scale?
I think that Portland has some of the most thoughtful regulations that have been developed, and large credit to the task force and because of all the public input that we have received. We're certainly doing some things that are very similar in other cities, but there are some differences in our regulations. For one, we made it very clear to the TNCs that they shall provide service to people with wheelchairs, where most cities had not been able to get that commitment from the TNCs.
And are other cities stricter than our proposed regulations on issues like levels of insurance, fingerprinting, trade dress, and cameras?
So the insurance issue, as has been discussed, is a national issue for the TNCs, and it was a very, very contentious issue for the past couple years. The TNCs were at heated odds against the insurers. They finally did come to an agreement with the current levels that are included in these proposed regulations.
How about the other issues?
For some of the other issues, I think that Portland is consistent in the way, in our standards for background checks and our standards for vehicle inspections. There is a lot of innovation happening in this industry, a lot of groundbreaking work, but there are some things that we know work and work well.
I would add that one of the things that Portland is probably at the high mark on is the requirement of citywide service as well, is what Brian said.
Okay, my next set of questions are first for Kate. This James River issue in the port, can you pick that apart for us and explain?
No, I'm really sorry. I just got called over here, and so I have not been following this.
I can do it. So the code has, for years, had a requirement that the insurance carriers be rated by the AM Best Company, which is an insurance rating agency that rates the level of insurance companies. At some point, and I think Ms. Kellington is accurate, somebody in the city approved EcoCab's insurer that was rated less than the A-minus standard by AM Best. I don't recall what it was, B, I believe, because that particular PBOT staffer had determined that a different rating agency had given them an A rating and that was sufficient. But neither risk management nor the city attorney's office had been consulted. The port has the same requirement, an AM Best rating of A minus with a financial size of 8 or greater for the insurers. And when EcoCab went to apply for port permits, the port said, hold on a second, you don't meet the AM Best rating, and they began discussions with us. We looked at it, and we consulted with risk management and Kate's shop and decided that, yes, the AM Best rating was the standard that the city of Portland wanted to have, and because the company didn't meet that, they needed to find a new insurer. Now, we gave them a grace period, and we gave all the companies a grace period that had insurance that didn't meet the AM Best A-minus, 8 or greater standard to come into compliance. And I'm trying to recall, but I believe it was something like the next time your insurance comes up for renewal, we need you to come into compliance with this. So that was the kind of workaround we provided. In the code, the new proposed code, we still use the AM Best company A-minus rating. We've taken out the financial size component of the insurers. And I'm not here to quibble with whether Demotech is a better rating agency or AM Best is a better rating agency. I rely on the advice of the risk management people who say that AM Best is the industry standard, and that's what is generally used to rate insurance agencies. Now, that could change as new things come into market, but as it stands today, that's what the city of Portland looks at, and that's what a number of other jurisdictions look at as well for determining the viability of the insurers. Now, the second piece to what Ms. Kellington...
Do we take a look at all about the issue was raised about some insurance companies are registered with the state while others aren't?
Yeah. Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman. That's the second piece of what Ms. Kellington raised, which is the admitted versus the non-admitted insurers or the surplus lines carrier. The new proposed code and the current interim administrative rules that the TNCs are operating under allow for a surplus lines insurer. And generally speaking, that is a non-admitted insurer that operates in a number of states. And the insurance people behind me can probably fill in the gaps. But essentially, they do not pay into the state guarantee fund. They do not have a product that's approved by the state insurance division, but they are approved as a surplus lines carrier for the state that they're operating in, and they have an insurance product that's approved in the state in which they're licensed, which I believe for James River is one of the Carolinas, north or south, I can't remember. So it is true that if James River were to fail for some reason, there would not be the state insurance guarantee fund to draw from. But, and I think Kate can address this, I don't think that's the state guarantee fund is a huge amount of reserves there, and that would have to cover all the claims in the state, not just TNC or taxi claims. Those are the two issues, and I think addressed everything that Ms. Kellington raised outside in the insurance context, not with regards to the colors and things like that.
So back to the colors issue. That's my other more global couple of questions really for you, Leah, and that is it was news to me today that at least some people believe that the proposed regulations affect pedicabs. It was also news to me that at least some people believe that the proposed regulations affect SAT or special access transportation vehicles. I raised the question earlier of what's the level of detail that the city council should engage in versus you as the administrator of this bureau and some advisory board. We deal with those issues all the time of where's that dividing point, and the discussion about the color scheme on the car to me might have dived below my threshold of what I think the city council ought to be engaged in, though I appreciate the fact that Commissioner Fish solved the problem. To use it again to go to some other areas, the city council adopts design review goals and objectives and says we want these goals and objectives and we want them applied to this part of the city. But we don't generally get involved into picking the color of people's window mullions.
What we often do is play the role of referee.
Yeah, I get that.
So I think that's why the threshold question should be, were the pedicab industry involved in these regulations?
Oh, fair enough.
Because frankly, for me, if they weren't, then I'm not interested in getting into the question of whether this is an improvement or not in the system. That's enough of a red flag that I think we should strip it out, have a conversation, and bring it back.
Yeah.
Because we're not the right body.
Right. Fair enough. But I'm raising the question of how this is going to work in practice, because it might not be that we've heard every detailed issue. We heard some new ones today, but we might not have heard every detailed issue about how this is going to get worked out in practice. Where is the boundary in this whole scheme between policy that's going to be set by the council and issues that are going to be worked out by your authority as Bureau Director with or without an advisory body? Because I've lost track of that boundary just this morning.
So if I can, a couple of comments. First, I'll start with the pedicabs. It's my understanding that the code that is before you today for approval is the same code that was in existence prior to the pilot being started, with one exception, that there is a requirement for pedicab drivers to have a driver's license. That is the only change that I am aware of.
So that's a proposed new requirement in code.
No, we need to clarify. So the pedicab regulations and the non-emergency medical transportation regulations are in wholesale the same as the status quo. And it was primarily done because we had not intensively engaged with those stakeholders. However, throughout the entire for-hire program, there are some changes that we're making, notably that the city is deregulating fares, and we are not restricting the number of permits. And we are proposing that the drivers apply to the company that they work for, as opposed to applying to the city, which is the status quo. And we did that in large part.
Mr. Hackett, we need to say apply to them. Can you elaborate on what that means?
Sure. So when a driver wants to work for any given taxi, TNC, or pedicab company, their first action is to approach that company, submit an application, the company reviews it, makes sure that the driver meets all of the city's requirements. The company is then responsible with contacting the city, presenting all the information to demonstrate that the vehicles and the drivers do meet all of the city requirements. We are able to pretty efficiently review and approve those applications to get those drivers and vehicles out there on the road. The current system is pretty administratively intensive and prevents us from doing the type of field enforcement that we want to.
If we could spend all day...
Turn your mic on, Nick.
Charlie raised the point about what's the right venue to have what discussion. I have to say, I don't think we are the right venue to discuss whether the pedicab concerns are well-founded in the code or not. I think having a follow-up meeting to find out whether there are provisions in this code that impact them and what their views are is important, particularly in light of the fact that we have a representation on the record that they were told that there was no reason to become engaged in this process because it wasn't going to have an impact on their industry. So whether that conversation happened or not is irrelevant, because we haven't adopted this code, so we still have an opportunity to sit down and say, what proposed changes impact your industry, and are there unintended consequences? And whatever the fruits of that conversation, you can report back to the council, and we have an option. We can strip pedicabs out altogether, or we can address any inconsistencies. But for me, I'd also like to know what did happen to the new chapter 6, the new proposed code in, I think it was 1641. What happened to that omnibus set of rewrite? Where is that in this? Is it in your proposal, or is it off to the side?
I'm not necessarily sure I understand that question fully, but it is Exhibit A within the ordinance itself. Is that what you're asking for?
Well, we were told that since 2009, there's been a lot of work in updating the non-motorist transportation chapter of our code. And we were also told that, at least by one person who testified, that package has not been accepted yet by the council. What's the status of that?
So correct. So the task force, the innovation task force, was primarily focused on taxis and TNCs. And I do want to make it very clear that we encourage participation at those meetings, input, both spoken and written, from any and everybody. However, you know, we did make it very clear to the different stakeholders what the focus of each meeting was. And throughout the entire task force's process, it was all focused on taxis and TNCs. Now, the 2009 recommendations pertaining to pedicabs, we have not gotten to those yet, again, because we had been focused on taxis and TNCs.
Not gotten those means that not a word has changed, right?
But I think it has, Mayor, because if 1640 is the pedicab, and it says in number 9 of 1640.775 about what you have to have in order to be a pedicab driver, number 9 says you have to have a year's continuous driving experience. And I was here with Commissioner Fish and Commissioner Saltzman when we adopted the pedicab rules, and there was a huge discussion about whether you had to actually be a licensed driver, and the answer was no.
Yeah.
So I don't think that is in the current code.
So the current code, Chapter 1640, the proposed new code, has a significant rewrite and restructuring. The current code is very challenging and difficult to read, in large part because the requirements for the different types of companies and the drivers are kind of interspersed throughout the entire code. We wanted to reorganize the code and by the type of company. So it was very clear to the companies and to the drivers what those requirements are. So there is renumbering of the code, certainly, but the actual requirements are the same. Now, there were a couple of unintentional edits that did make it into this exhibit, which we wanted to correct with this amendment here. And those do address a couple of missed references to a couple of requirements. One of those was the driver's license. The current pedicab requirement is that drivers have to have either a driver's license or a government-issued ID. And that is referenced 3 times in the code. There were 2 occasions where we unintentionally left off the government-issued ID, but we put that back in there. Because we did not intend to have any changes for the other types of companies.
So you don't have a change, though, to 1640.775, number 9, and that requires that there be a year of continuous driving experience. It's on page 126.
Yeah, so could you give us that reference one more time?
It's page 126, and it's 1640.775, number 9.
You see that, Ken?
Yeah. It's the, she's referencing the standard kind of criminal background check requirements.
So that would pertain to a driver who presented a driver's license at the time of application.
But no, it says that they will not be certified as a pedicab driver if any of the following conditions exist. So that if they can't prove that they've had a driver's license for a year, they would not be a certified pedicab driver.
That would be correct if they, yes, that would be correct.
But that's not what we passed for pedicabs.
So this
that would be a new point to me, yeah.
But this illustrates for me, look, if we were in Salem, not Portland, at this point, the committee chair would say, I direct an industry representative and committee staff to hold a meeting to go through the language, review any changes in the language that impact that industry, see if there's concurrence, and if there are things that are not that cannot be agreed to, that comes back to council.
And I'm very inclined to do just that. I thought that's my question of Leah is, isn't that what the board's supposed to do?
Well, I'll just speak for myself. I don't think the council should adopt legislation that has unintended consequences that can be corrected or that has changes in the law that have not been discussed adequately with an impacted part of the marketplace. And while we've had lots of hearings, as you point out, about the main event here, we're now hearing some things that haven't been the subject. And we can flag them. We can spend an hour flagging all the inconsistencies, but we could also require staff to sit down with the industry, go through this, and report back to us if there's any concerns.
I have a question of timing. I mean,
you need to answer my question first.
Thank you. Sure. We have had some preliminary conversations with the pedicab industry. I do believe several more are warranted. They have some issues that I don't believe we've resolved to their satisfaction. So if the will of the council is to direct us to go back and work with them and bring back forward changes, we would be in agreement with that.
And we also started stakeholder meetings with companies and
what was the other?
Medical.
Medical, yeah. So we have already started that work because we do want to move forward.
So can we do that and still move this ordinance to second reading?
No, sorry. Let me clarify. So we, because the task force had not engaged with the other stakeholders, we've already known that there are other changes to the other types of companies that they want to see made. We have not had those stakeholder meetings publicly. We had preliminary conversations with a couple of the company owners to get a sense of where they would like to see the new code go. So again, we wanted to preserve the status quo in large part for the other companies beyond taxis, TNCs, and town cars, and begin the work with the stakeholders and with the public to update the code throughout the entirety, in its entirety.
Okay, my question is, can we move to second reading on the broader ordinance next week and still be talking to the pedicabs, or do we need to add an amendment saying, notwithstanding anything else in here, nothing this has, what we're passing today has nothing to do with pedicabs, and then have those discussions later on?
You'd have to move to remove that section and the NEMT section from what would be passed today, because I wanted to go back to the city attorney and get an answer to my question. Does the council have the authority to delegate to the director to waive sections of code?
Push your button.
I can't hear you.
Mayor Hale, Commissioner Fritz, in answer to your question about whether you can delegate authority that's in the code, you can't amend the code and just delegate authority if it's not already delegated in the code. I was hearing something about rules and codes, and that's why I was trying to determine whether you were talking about amending rules or amending code, but amending code would take another act of council.
So no, we cannot delegate
authority, so you can't. Okay. You can't just delegate authority without something in the code already authorizing that without an amendment.
Yes, we'd either have to take all sections out of the ordinance, say, deal with this by administrative rule, give the director authority to do that.
It's tough to amend the code. Well, I mean, there wouldn't be anything in the code on pedicabs at that point.
Right, that's what I'm saying. That is an option. I'm not necessarily recommending it. But in other words, to get to the environment in which the director and her staff works through these technical issues and resolves them outside of council, we'd have to do that.
So, Mayor, there actually is a very simple way we could do that, which is we could say that with respect to any provision of the code which is different from status quo that applies to pedicabs, they shall not be implemented until the earlier of the director reporting back with a set of amendments or 90 days, and that's just becomes the transition period. So we're just maintaining the status quo for that 90-day period, no changes, because you've said that the intent was to maintain the status quo, and then they report back either a change to the code applicable tailored to the industry or not. But that way we're assured of the status quo, and we simply specifically direct that there be no change from the status quo until the director either comes back or a certain period of time elapses.
Mr. McGarry, what do you think of that idea?
I think that works. I mean, I know Ms. Brown is looking at it, but I think that works. I would only say 90 days may not be enough given.
Well,
yeah.
I wouldn't have a, if you let the clock run out, then the new code goes into place.
Right. Could I add?
Think it would be until the director comes back.
We could say that that there shall be no change in the status quo for 6 months, or earlier, if the director comes back with some kind of representation, because if she comes back and says all is well with the world, then I don't want to hold it up. If she comes back and says there's issues to be worked out, then I want the moratorium in place until that code comes to council.
Why have any kind of date? Why not just say until the director comes back?
I want to make sure this is only applying to pedicabs, NEMTs, and SATs.
Unless you tell us it should be broader. At this point,
I think you can direct that the sections that apply to those particular industries have the moratorium, we'll figure out the code
reference. From the status quo.
Correct.
So there is an existing regulatory system.
There's a code in place.
And we're saying no changes to that code until such time as the director comes back with a recommendation.
Correct.
I would offer that as an amendment.
For the particular industries we talked about.
Just the industries that you've identified.
Okay.
Okay, that's been moved and seconded. Do you want to take action on that amendment at this point? I'd be happy to. Okay, let's do. Please, roll call.
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
I very much appreciate both the discussion and the testimony that prompted the discussion. Aye.
Houseman?
Aye.
Hale?
Aye. Good. Okay. Got that?
So I have, Mayor, can I ask, since we're just posing questions?
Yeah.
And this may be to Commissioner Novick or to our panel. We heard in one of the prior hearings someone observe that if we impose a surcharge or a fee on a fare for the purpose of creating a fund to take care of a laudable public purpose, that it may, under the compensation agreement between the driver and a TNC, a portion of that fund may go into the wrong pocket. Is that true, and is there any way that we can regulate that, since any fee or charge that we're contemplating, in my sense, in my words, was sort of meant to be something in the nature of a pass-through, not as a tool to inflate gross receipts so that the 20% off the top gets bigger? Does that make sense?
Yes, but I thought that that's kind of, I mean, the 50 cents is going to be paid to the city to administer the program, so it's not going to be money that Uber gets.
Well,
one way or another, I mean, if we had a permit, regular old permit fee as opposed to a 50 cent charge, then Uber winds up taking that out, either charging it to customers or taking it out of its own shareholders or taking it out of drivers. I mean, the fact of how we do it doesn't affect how much money Uber makes.
It's designed to be, I mean, I was sort of the suggester of the idea, as a straight pass-through to the passenger. So it doesn't go through the driver's hands, doesn't go through the cab company's hands, doesn't go through Uber or Lyft's hands. It goes straight to the city from the passenger.
Yeah, and the way that we wrote the...
How would that be done for the TNCs? Everything goes through Uber.
Well, I mean, they have to remit. Yes, I mean, it would be on your receipt, you know, as a surcharge from the city of Portland. And, yeah, the companies do have to remit that amount to the cities, yeah, to the city, I should say.
But, Steve,
but it doesn't count as driver income. It doesn't count as Uber income.
Can't we specifically provide that it shall not be deemed X or Y subject to whatever fee a TNC takes from that transaction, so it's clear it's a pure pass-through?
Well, but we don't regulate the relation. We're not regulating the relationship between the TNCs and their drivers. I mean, the 20% thing is something that Uber has applied, but I mean, we didn't regulate how the taxi cabs pass on the permit fees to their drivers either.
Yeah, but here's the difference: if we keep adding fees and charges which we think are laudable for a public purpose, we may be inadvertently reducing the net income to the driver. That wasn't our intent. It was to create a pool of funds to cover a public purpose, not to adversely impact the driver.
But why would it? I mean, why would it adversely impact the driver? Because the driver gets 80% of the fee. I mean, of the charge. You could argue
that
it gives the driver another 80 cents. Neither is true. The money ends up going to the city.
It goes to Dan's point about who's responsible for remitting the payment. And if it's clearly the TNC's responsibility, then it seems less likely it'll be part of the formula. If it's not clear in the code, it could end up being partially funded by the driver, and that was not our intent.
So the detail of the permit fee, that surcharge, is on page 140, and it says it requires that the taxis and the TNCs add to receipts the 50 cents and with the line item City of Portland surcharge. We will bill all companies quarterly and collect those fee rates from them. Does that help clarify anything?
So the companies will send us a check for the aggregate amount of those 50 cent charges.
Yeah, that's fine. Looks, you got it right there. So I did have a A question about the decals. I mean, I'm a little disturbed to see everybody holding up Uber decals today. So what about the issue of, I mean, we are going to require that the decals be back in front now. But what about the issue that they somehow carry a serial number or something that shows that the city has, you know, issued the decals?
Yeah, so that again kind of goes back to the whole app. So there's drivers cannot be on the app on the platform without having been cleared by the city. So Uber and Lyft provide to us, the city, a list of applicant drivers. Those drivers are not active until we say that they are certified. So that in and of itself. And the business license is a unique identifying number that we are using for the TNC drivers at this time. So we feel confident, and maybe Leah can speak
to this.
I guess I'm
thinking of just the sort of the safety angles that have been brought up here. So you're coming out of the bars at 2 a.m., and you see cars with that Uber or the Lyft mustache, whatever. But, you know, given that, you know, people are holding them up here in the audience, anybody could get those decals. So that's what I'm thinking about is if I saw a decal that had a city serial number on it or something like that, I guess I'd feel a little more safe.
Yeah, so go ahead.
Because I think, like, if you're coming out of the bars at 2 a.m., you may not be as likely to do your research on the driver history.
Other commissioner, if you're coming out of a bar at 2 a.m., are you going to memorize the identification number of the taxi either?
You can look like
it. But you see it. I mean, at least you'll know to look for it. Yeah.
What passengers really need to be looking for is the app, because it does provide that detailed information about the driver and the vehicle, which we have found to be more useful for customers than just a city identifying number. And again, those drivers are not available for street hails, so you're not supposed to be just walking into any car. In fact, there was an incident where a woman mistakenly entered a non-TNC vehicle, did not have the decal on it, and the Uber driver actually contacted the passenger because on the driver's app, they also get some information about the passenger and who they should be expecting to enter that vehicle.
And this is somewhat relevant in that it's not limited to the TNCs. We have several cases on our files of people impersonating cab drivers as well. So this is where enforcement is really critical in this industry.
But at least, you know, for our cab companies, we're requiring, you know, a color scheme, a decal, and Uber vehicles were only requiring this U.
Again, the app in and of itself is essentially a digital city certification number.
And the app provides, I think, more app information about the driver and the car than you normally have when you get into a cab.
So another issue that came up in testimony, fingerprinting versus name-based background checks. Could you elaborate on that?
Actually, Dave Benton is kind of a resident expert on that. Would you mind if he was called up?
You're probably done, Gabe.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Council. How are you? Fingerprinting. There's a couple things been talked about here. One is biometric or live scan. Currently in the state of Oregon, the only agencies that have live scan where you actually scan a fingerprint and it's transmitted to the state are police agencies, and then there's one private vendor with Department of Administrative Services who has that. So right now, if you use live scan, although there are vendors out there, and I've spoken to the state police and I've spoken to one, there's no direct transmit. It's live scan. It gets printed on a fingerprint card and it gets just mailed in the standard way to Salem. Certainly you can do that. There are private vendors out there that provide that service, and then it takes 7 to 10 days to run through the fingerprint check.
Why is that the technological connection?
Well, we just haven't caught up quite yet. The state police is working on it. They just haven't got the systems in place for private vendors to transmit to the state. I think that's where they're going, but we're just not there yet.
So on my iPhone 6, I have the thumbprint recognition to turn it on. as technology increases, is that not going to be available to everybody?
Commissioner, I believe it, relative to criminal background checks, if that's what we're talking about, I think the state police wants to get us to a place where you can do live scan and it is a direct submit to the state, and we'll get there, but they're just not there administratively yet. We can still do that with an ink card or a computer-generated card.
Yeah, so fingerprinting, whether it's electronic or manual, it's quite possible to do it.
Oh, it can be done. We can't do it, but there are private vendors out there who can provide that service, and when you check a private-for-hire driver, the state only queries the state of Oregon.
Why would we not require that?
You certainly can. It has some limited value. It doesn't. There's a misnomer that you verify identity. You don't. You're just testing against a known database of people that have either been arrested, or there's a limited number of folks. Like in my previous lives, I was a police officer, physicians, and a few others. They maintain records of those folks. But other than that, if you don't compare against somebody who's in the system, it doesn't verify identity.
It would for immigrants, though, because everybody who's not a U.S. citizen gets fingerprinted on entry.
I don't know about the retention of those records. I'm suspecting those are kept in the federal system. And for those employment checks, the state police only checks the state system.
Another issue on my list. Sorry, we're all running through multiple levels here. The issue that was raised by both EcoCab being disadvantaged by old school, as they were describing it, provisions in our regulations, in terms of meters and those kinds of things. Again, are we changing the rules in this proposal? Are we failing to change the rules? Why are we erupting on that front at this juncture in this process?
Oh, that's a good question. We are not changing the rules for meters today, and this is a new issue that for us today as well, so we're happy to work with EcoCab moving forward on their issues, but this was a new one for us today as well.
Then we talked about this a little bit, but Mr. Alame's point about requiring the change of insurance rating, how are we going to resolve that one?
So we have taken out the requirement of a certain financial size, but the AM Best Company A-minus rating still exists.
The change in the size requirement doesn't solve his problem.
No. We've given them a period of time to come into compliance, which is, I believe, at their next renewal period. I had a lengthy conversation with Mr. DeGrange yesterday in which he stated to me, and I committed to him to continue looking at the Demotech issue with the risk managers, but he stated to me that that there is a larger company that meets the AM Best rating that will be writing paper for insurers in the state that do taxicab insurance products. So that should be coming into play in the next, I think he said, 30 days.
What's the problem we're trying to solve with restricting to AM Best A-minus rather than the Demotech B?
There's a number of rating agencies that are available within the insurance industry. AM Best has been the gold standard for a lot of years. All of the commercial insurance that we place for the city is AM Best rated. Brokerage houses have teams of people that review the rating agencies' assessment of different insurance companies. And the problem that I would see for the city is, which rating agency do you want? And if you have multiple rating agencies that rate the particular insurer differently, who do you choose? And so it really is more of a practical matter of how do you select which rating it is that you want to use if the rating agency looks
Is it true that AM Best doesn't include promptness of paying claims as part of one of their criteria?
I don't know. I wouldn't be too surprised, but they really are looking at the financial solvency of an insurer as opposed to their claims handling process.
Given the litigious nature of car crashes, I would suggest that including whether or not companies pay up promptly should be part of our criteria.
Other questions?
Yes, I have one. Are TNC drivers covered by the state law that says it's a felony to assault a taxi cab driver?
If it's a felony, I'm not sure where the question comes from. If it's a felony to assault a taxi cab driver, then everybody would be covered by that. Is that what you mean? Or if they're the ones who are assaulted?
The state law specific, and it's going to the section of the code that says that the taxis are required to have cameras, and the cameras are required to have it posted underneath that it's a state law, it's a felony to assault a taxi driver. And the state law specifically says taxi drivers and defines that and does not include TNCs.
I don't know. I'd have to look at the definition in the state law. Obviously, you have, but we'd have to look at the definition in the state law.
So part of the reason for my question is for the safety of cab drivers or private for hire drivers. That's the reason that we put in requirements for cameras was not for passenger safety but for driver safety. And indeed, in researching the Uber driver safety, my main concern isn't for passengers. It's mostly assaults by passengers on drivers. So what's the safeguard, like we have the proposal or the current requirement, and we're keeping that for cameras with the sign that says it's a felony, how are Uber drivers to be protected from passengers who may be drunk and or assaultive?
Well, again, the app does provide some safeguards in the sense that the driver's activities, locations are known through that app. So in the course of an investigation to determine what happened in an alleged assault or something like that, that information would be very helpful.
Well, and the identity of the passenger.
Right, absolutely.
Of one of the passengers, if there's more than one, there might be some question about that. And but
the identification of the passengers in a taxi vehicle is not captured in the same way with the camera as it is with the app.
And the council, I believe, decided not to have the camera turned on. Moving to enforcement, a case was made in Broward County, Florida, that since you have to have a phone to order an Uber, each city employee can only do a spot check once, because then that phone number will be collected in the database by Uber or Lyft and be known to be an inspector. So we're not going to be able to do random checks the way that we can with taxi drivers. How do you propose to address that problem?
We currently are doing random checks more than once on our phones and haven't been removed from the app, so it's not been our experience here in Portland, but I believe we have the authority to compel the TNCs to leave us on the app, because we have had some instances of people being removed and have worked with those companies to say that people need to have access to the app, and it has been resolved very quickly, and an agreement's been reached that we would not be banned.
Wouldn't they, though, have the capacity to only direct your request for a ride to the drivers that they know are certified?
That's conceivable.
In the same way that taxis could only dispatch a pristine driver upon our request.
Taxis can get hailed.
Yeah, you can also call them.
So you can do the spot check on a taxi, but you potentially cannot, because part of the verification requirements that you've talked about is, because it's the same with the Airbnb. How do we know who's not being reported to us? So we assume that any company with people with brains in it would only give us driver's license numbers of drivers that they know have done all of the required steps. There could be an entire shadow community of drivers that Uber just says have at it, but they don't connect our inspectors to those drivers.
And if we found that our checkers were constantly being directed to the same five drivers, that's something that we could definitely look at. But, there can be shadow communities of anything. There could be people painting their cars to look like taxi cabs and driving around, and we wouldn't find them by calling taxi cab companies.
I think the inter-world right now says that they can't block us from the app, so that's part of what the rules say now.
They can allow us on, but only give us certain drivers, though.
I guess that's conceivable, but.
And then moving on to defensive driving requirements, as far as, did you have a concept of what the training will be that's required, and will it be annual, every 2 years requirement for annual for recertification in defensive driving?
I was going to ask Mark Williams, excuse me, gosh, Mark or Dave to come up and talk about that part for you, please.
I'm Mark Williams. Good morning. Mark Williams, program manager for the Pride for Hire program. Repeat the question for me, please.
The taxi companies now give their drivers every 2 years they have to take a defensive driving class. I don't see any reference to defensive driving classes having to be taken in the TNC code.
But we don't. But the city does not require the taxi cabs to impose that requirement to the drivers, do we?
Correct. I understand that some of the taxi cab companies require that internally, but we don't have that requirement in the code.
And why would we not, while we have the opportunity to have safer drivers, if we're going to Vision Zero here where all drivers are and all road users are more safe, why would we not take this opportunity to get a couple of thousand, 5,000 more drivers trained in defensive driving?
And because PBOT has adopted Vision Zero as a priority, that is a new requirement
that we have put into the training requirements. It's obviously not as full. It's different from defensive driving. But we are looking forward to advancing the Vision Zero priority through this opportunity by required training.
Why wouldn't we do it right now?
For Vision Zero training? We're developing the curriculum
driving.
Right now. We never have required defensive driving, so that would be a big departure from the current training and testing requirements.
Commissioner, you brought this issue up to me a few days ago, and this is... Apparently, in the entire history of the taxicab industry, this has not been a requirement. That doesn't mean that it's not a requirement that we should consider for the entire industry. I'm just hesitant to shoehorn it in today as part of this bigger process because we want to have both the taxi companies and the TNCs and the drivers as part of a conversation about that. So I'm perfectly willing to have that conversation, which we haven't had previously. I just don't know if we should rush to do it immediately.
Okay, well, I have actually brought it up multiple times before a few days ago. And then my final question is on 1640.020, the nonsensical check, yeah. Part A.
I didn't realize that you wanted us to rewrite that. That is, again, the existing language that's been around forever. If you'd like us to propose an amendment, we can bring it back. Obviously, we're going to have meetings with various stakeholders.
Well, I realize these hearings have been very long, but we did actually have that discussion at the last hearing, and we were supposed to work together on that. So, yes, I would like that rewritten, please.
If I could, Dave Benson has some further information to share with you on the Uber and Lyft apps and access to that for enforcement.
Commissioner, I did hear your question about anonymizing phone numbers, and we can do that, and we've already considered that. You can go to any store and buy a phone with a data app on it where you can get applications. It has a new phone number on it, and we intend to do that. And so we constantly cycle through phone numbers, so any of the companies won't know, and we'll keep changing the numbers, so they won't know who's calling them or who's on the app requesting the ride.
And there's an app that does that for you? We'll change the
No, we'll
originating...
buy the phones.
Oh,
like
I see.
The track
okay.
phone, for instance, you can buy okay. it with a data app, has a brand new number, nobody knows who's using it.
But then you use it, then it becomes known, and then you sell it again, or that sounds pretty expensive.
No, we just use it. They're very inexpensive. You can use them for short periods of time. They're disposable, and then we can just get another phone.
Since we're relying on phone numbers and to be verifying people, what's to stop the companies from doing that, the drivers from doing that?
Well, again, if we're constantly cycling through phones and phone numbers, they're not going to know us. And then we'll, as time goes on, we'll go back to the store and we'll get more phones with different numbers. So we'll keep cycling through the numbers, so there'll be always a fresh crop of numbers out there.
And to circle back on your question about the third degree assault,
one of my colleagues from upstairs brought down the statute for me. They're always watching up there. But you're correct. It only says a taxi driver, and that would be a change that would need to be made to the legislature to fix that for TNC drivers. It's an analog code in a digital world.
Be clear to our friends, the Uber drivers and Lyft drivers who've come here testifying, you're not covered by collision in the primary period, and if you're assaulted, then you're not covered for that either.
Well, it's not charged as a third-degree assault rather than assault.
So I did have an amendment I wanted to offer on the decals, and I'll just read it. I only have one copy. It's courtesy of Commissioner Fish. It would say that the TNC under 16.40.250, it would read that the transportation network company may not dispatch a vehicle unless the director has issued a PFHT vehicle decal for that vehicle. The director will issue a PFHT vehicle decal, including an identification number specific to each PFHT vehicle, upon certification by the director that the vehicle meets all requirements under Chapter 16.40.
Second.
That gets us into the, I think we have to think about that, because that gets us into the business of manufacturing decals, which we don't do at this point. Director Treat, do you want to address
that? I do. Thank you. Well, I appreciate the spirit of your amendment. It also would be adding some very heavy administrative burden to PBOT staff to be available on a daily basis to review TNC documents and hand out these decals, and currently don't have that staffing capacity. The number of drivers that are onboarded on a daily basis far exceeds our administrative ability to administer decals to them on a daily basis.
You could charge for it, for cost recovery.
Of specific TNC decal on these vehicles. I think that that might be another issue that we should focus on and commit to coming back to council to report on any suggestions for improvements on trade dress signage or decals.
I was thinking, I guess I kind of envisioned it working this way. That would be that Uber or Lyft, whatever, would print their decals with some sort of serial number on them. And then as they assign them to a driver, they would report that to us, the driver and the serial number of the decal.
Yeah, and we're actually already getting information that connects the driver to the vehicle just because we get specific driver information and specific vehicle information.
So I think it's intended for, you know, Commissioner Fish and I were just kind of talking about what, so we're downtown and we get run over, our foot gets run over by an Uber vehicle, you know. So maybe I'll catch the license plate. Maybe I won't even know it's an Uber vehicle, because they are kind of hard to tell. If they're just, you know, they look just like another black sedan, unless you really know where to look for the label. And this is just a way of having a particular identifier associated with vehicle for those of us who aren't on the app. You know, we're not looking at the driver, not any of that.
Well, I'm struggling to understand the problem we're trying to solve and the scenario you just described. The car has a license plate.
Right.
So that's pretty big lettering.
Right.
So how are we going to see the lettering on a label any better than we're going to see the lettering on a license plate?
I grant that point. I guess I would know that the vehicle is a truly an Uber or a Lyft vehicle if it had a serial number as opposed to an imposter.
Well, maybe this has been a long hearing. I mean, we're all a little punchy.
Yeah.
I don't really care if it's an Uber or a Lyft vehicle if it runs over my foot, but I damn sure want to know who it was. So the license plate is pretty important to me. I'm trying to understand how that would, given that the driver and the vehicle are linked in the app, right? I know that that car is driven by this person because they're on the app and they're registered with us. Seems to me we have the informational equivalent of a sticker. And maybe more.
Yeah.
Well, I guess one of the points that I would say in support of this is that, I keep hearing these statistics about all the Uber and Lyft vehicles on our streets. And since my daughter moved to Europe, I've had the benefit of driving her car to work. And maybe it's because of my advanced age and what's happened to my eyes. But I almost never see the decal for either cars, and yet I'm told there are hundreds, if not thousands, of cars. I think Dan's point is, sure, you hopefully get a driver's, you hopefully get the license. I've noticed that a lot of cars have dirty license plates, or they're obscured, or the light isn't on, so there's at night it's harder. I don't see the Uber decal, and I think they are discreetly placed. I almost never see them, but I'm told they're all around us. And this would have two benefits. One is a clearly identifying marker, and two, you could also, to someone, I mean, I sometimes get in the wrong cab, not because I'm gaming the system, but because I'm someplace and I need a cab, and I call the cab, another cab calls, shows up. It turns out they're showing up for Dan, but I get in the car not knowing that, and blah, blah, blah. So I frequently get in the wrong cab, if you will, in terms of, I'm sorry to acknowledge that publicly to my friends who are left hanging, but it happens. And what's wrong with having a little more formal identification with a serial number that's sort of like a good housekeeping seal that gives the customer an added level, or the victim of an accident, an added level of protection, particularly because what I think Dan is envisioning is something that you could run off in a typical printer in an office situation. So with a little adhesive. So what would be so burdensome about that? Because we certainly don't want you, Leah, to get in the business of having to create a whole new shop around this, but couldn't we just impose this requirement on the TNC and have them certify they're in compliance? I think that might get close to the micromanaging the mayor's going to admonish us on. I think I would be comfortable with you coming back with a recommendation.
That would also take care of the enforcement issues. If there's numbers, I mean, this is what we didn't do with Airbnb, is require that they have the numbers posted for everyone.
I'd like to see it big enough so that, I mean, one of the things I'm always reminded by my friends at Elders in Action is that it has to be big enough for the graying part of our population to be able to read, and that means a sufficient font.
I mean, maybe what we could use is the business license number they have to have, and have that, you know, have a strip of adhesive with that number on it.
Yeah. That sounds good.
That sounds good.
But that wouldn't tell you that they've gone through all the trainings.
Well, but they're...
Neither would a bogus number, but if it's a business license number issued by the city, I guess I'm not hugely enamored of this idea at all, but I don't think we should be issuing two numbers. As a city, whatever number we issue ought to be the number.
Yeah, I think business license number sounds good.
So it's been moved and seconded.
Okay, any further discussion on this amendment? So let's take a vote, please, on this amendment.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Kaufman?
Aye.
Hales?
No, but it passes. Okay, now other amendments. Okay, so you have both amendments that were printed and adopted by the council earlier in this discussion. You had additional verbal amendments. They've been recorded. That gives you the ability, Commissioner Novick, to bring us back an ordinance on second reading that's amended by council discussion. We also have a lot of other requests and follow-up that the Bureau needs to provide. Anything else before we close the hearing?
Do we need to actually move the sections to be taken out with Commissioner Fish's amendment for the pedicab?
Sure. I think you already did that. Didn't
you? We already adopted his amendment.
The way I framed it was anything that is at variance with status quo would not be enforced until such time as, and we're leaving it to your good offices to make sure that nothing that's at variance from the status quo is enforced.
Okay. Mayor, I don't know that any testimony was taken on that amendment, and leave it to...
I think testimony was taken on that subject, so
okay.
I think we've covered the subject of whether or not pedicabs and special access transportation is whether we intended to change the game for them, and we do not, and that's why Commissioner Fisher's amendment was adopted.
We're about to lose a quorum, Tim.
We are. Okay, so we'll close the hearing, and this is scheduled for second reading next week.